You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story
is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us again this week, whether you're listening or watching live, or you're picking this up down the road through the podcast link. We're just happy you're with us. That was Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band that started the show off with a little bit of their song, Hot Texas. Jim, who's our special guest tonight?
Our guest tonight, W. Michael Farmer.
Yes, and there he is.
Folks.
Hey, Michael.
Hey. Hi, Michael. We're so happy you're with us tonight.
I'm delighted to be here.
Where are you joining us from?
I'm in Smithfield, Virginia. That's about 20 miles west of the Norfolk coast.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So it's a little late your time.
Well, not as late as it was for some of our writer friends in Europe, for example.
That's true.
Well, that's true.
Manuela, he's talking about Manuela Schneider. Yes, absolutely. Well, we are so happy. Yeah. We have been reading this. We have finished reading this fabulous book. This is the book we're going to be talking about tonight. And Michael, help me. Is it Trini or Trini?
Trini.
Trini.
It's short for Trinidad.
Right. So Trini. We were having a little discussion this afternoon.
Back and forth on this thing.
Trini or Trini? So Trini Come, Geronimo's Captivity of Trinidad Verden. And Jim is going to do a little intro for you, and then we're going to get starting to talk about Michael's writing background and this book.
Okay, today's guest, W. Michael Farmer, a retired PhD physicist with a passion for the history of the Western frontier, combining 15-plus years of research in 19th-century Apache history and culture in his own Southwest living experience. He fills his stories with a genuine sense of time and place. His novels have won numerous awards, including 3 Will Rogers Gold and 5 Silver Medallions at New Mexico Arizona Book Awards for adventure, historical fiction, and literary fiction. His book series includes Legends of the Desert, The Life and Times of Yellow Boy, Mescalero Apache, and Apache Life, featuring the book we'll be discussing. Trini, come. Please welcome W. Michael Farmer.
Hello,
Michael. Hi, Michael. Michael to our to your friends, right?
Yes.
I certainly hope so.
Well, we were both absolutely captured and engrossed with this book. And as our listeners and watchers know, if they've tuned into the show regularly, we start reading and one of us will be a little ahead of the other. And then the other will get a little bit ahead, and then we don't want to do spoiler alerts for each other. So we'll say, did you get to the part with, and give a little something, and then we'll say, oh, I'm not there yet.
Yeah, what page are you on?
Yeah, okay. What page are you on? And this kept us turning these pages. Michael, some might say this, you do describe it as historical fiction, but it also really is an adventure, isn't it?
Well, certainly it is. And while it is historical fiction, because, you know, there's no record of what was said and where the Apaches went, except within a large area, I think it's about as historical as you can as you can hope to get.
Tell us, before we get more into the book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and when did you start writing?
Well, I started writing fiction about 2003. And that was after I had finished a couple of technical books that kind of summarized what I had been doing as a physicist. And when those books got printed, I really didn't have a lot to do writing-wise. And there's a legend in New Mexico. It's more of a great mystery. Called the Fountain Murders. And I've always been curious about that, and I decided that I would follow Oakley Hall's advice and try to write a fictional account with as much information as I had so that I could probably try to understand what had really gone on there. And I discovered that it really was a great time. I really enjoyed the writing and learning what to do and the right word to use, as Mark Twain said. And I was hooked. I originally intended to write maybe a 10 or 20,000 word short story about the fountains. And when I finished the first book, it was about 180,000 words, and it turned into a trilogy. And then the publisher, which was a small independent press in Sierra Vista, Arizona, had major problems, bad health problems, and she had to close. And so I was left wondering what I should do. And I realized that one of the characters in the books about the fountains was a gentleman named Yellow Boy, who was a Mescalero Apache. And he was the one that I was really interested in. And so I decided that I would try to write a history of the Mescalero Apaches from about 1860 to about 1920, and use him as the eyes and the ears about what went on and what the problems were that the Apaches had. And that's how I got into writing about Apaches.
So interesting.
We were talking about the fountains early this afternoon. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, because we were looking through more of your other subjects and titles, and it's like, I was making the list. I want to read that one. I need to read that one. And when I was reading about the fountains, I remembered being on a trip with my parents and we went through White Sands. We were actually following kind of the trail of Billy the Kid. But somewhere along the line, we came across, I have a very vague memory of a home or a property, and it had fountain on the outside of it. And my dad was like, well, this looks like let's just pull over here and let's go in. And the woman that met us was, I think, a relative of the Fountain family. And this was kind of like a museum, a house, their home. And I always found the story fascinating, but, you know, again, had sort of put it out of my mind until we were reading today. It's like, oh, I got to read those books.
Well, you're a rare person. Usually you get outside of Las Cruces, Mesilla, and there are relatively few people who know what you're talking about.
When did your interest in Apaches start?
Well, I can remember in the fourth grade reading a history about the Plains Indians, and I was really taken with the idea of their life and the lifestyle that they had. And I read about the Plains Indians, and when I got out of that phase for a while. When I came back, I started reading more about the Indians that were close to Las Cruces and Mesilla, which were the Mescaleros. And I got a book on the culture of the Apaches, how to understand why they did what they did. And this is primarily the Chiricahua Apaches. And I discovered that when you want to write, you need to understand the culture. And that will help you understand why those people did what they did when they did. And so I really got to studying the Apaches about the same time that I started writing the Fountain books.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Let's before we take a very quick break, I'd love to talk a little bit about the cover of the book. If you would tell us. Of course, we're looking at Trini Come, and this phrase has a very important role in the book. I am curious. They could have called it so many different things. What led you to title it Trini Come? And then tell us about the two images that are on the cover.
The image of the Indian is Geronimo, and it was taken in 1886. As a matter of fact, when he told General Crook that he was going to surrender, the picture of the young woman there is just a painting. I can't tell you who she is, but I found it, and it's in public domain, and that looks like a good way to illustrate who she was. It's interesting because Trinidad has quite a few relatives still surviving, and I got a note from a lady who was remotely related to her, and she said, "And Trinidad's face in that cover then was somewhat darker." And she said, "Well, she was very fair, and that's why Geronimo took her." Well, that's not quite right, because Apaches considered white people very weak. And they were kind of insulted if some white man married into them.
Interesting. That's so interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting fact.
She's a remarkable young woman. Just yes, remarkable. It is a remarkable story. And you, the author, take us through this adventure through her first person narrative. Right. What led you to decide, did you know you always wanted to do that, or did you try another way and then said, no, I have to do it through her? Tell us a little bit about how you came to make that decision.
Well, I think of writers as being like actors, and you wind up having to assume the identity of a person in a play. And I really wanted to see what the Geronimo Apaches were like, although I had written several books about them already, from somebody that was there that participated in their daily life and was still being dragged around the country trying to dodge the people that were trying to catch him. And so I thought, well, let me try telling the story from her point of view. And I wrote a couple of chapters, and I really liked the way she was turning out. So that's why I continued to tell the whole story through her eyes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question or a comment?
Yeah. So she was a real person,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, she, I think doing it through her eyes as readers, we're seeing everything as she's seeing it for a first time. So when she's describing whether it's going to sleep or it's on horseback riding through an area, or, you know, we are with Geronimo and his band, and we have no foreknowledge. We're learning exactly as she's learning.
Right.
And I think that engages the reader tremendously. And she's very perceptive, isn't she?
Most people, when they learned that she had been taken by the Apaches, they didn't expect her to live but a few days before they killed her and left her body wherever. And so, you know, when they finally she finally got free, there was a lot of surprise that she had in fact survived. And I think the reason that she did was that she was willing to learn from the Apaches. And if she was going to try to escape, and she definitely wanted to do that, but they had told her that if she left and they caught her, they would kill her. And so she was quite careful in being sure that she tried to make them happy. Yeah. with who she was, and they were. They were quite taken with her, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, you know, we had a 12-year-old girl here, and I'm thinking, you know, she almost thinks like an 18-year-old.
Oh yeah.
You know, she's mature behind her chronological age.
Yeah.
And you write it very well, and you write it to the point that she thinks things through, and she doesn't make the right rash decisions. And like you say, she thinks she wants to escape, but she knows, wait a minute, I can't do it now. I want to do it now, but I can't. It wouldn't be right. They're going to catch me. They will kill me. I'll have to wait till a better time to escape. And she goes through this in her mind all the time.
And she can't let on to them that she's thinking about it. She really has to have them also believe that she's part of the family. And right. So that's not always an easy thing to do, especially when you're 12. Yeah. Michael, we're going to take a very quick break. We want all of our followers to find out one of the places that they can get your books. And so we're just going to take a moment to talk about our Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. Don't go away, anybody. Stay right where you are. Michael, stay right where you are, and we'll be right back.
I'll be here.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer, with Jim and Bobby Bell, and our special guest, W. Michael Farmer.
And we're talking about the book Trinity we just finished.
Come.
Yes, Trinity Come. Oh, my goodness.
And we've just been discussing Trinity.
Trinity, Trinidad, learning a little bit more about her. So we don't really want to do a lot of spoiler alerts, and yet there's some really important things happen, obviously. The title says Geronimo's Captivity of Trinidad. So how do they meet, Michael?
Well, the entire Apache tribe had been exiled east. They were living in forts, in a fort in Florida. The only Chiricahuas that were left were the little band that Geronimo and his chief, Naiche, led. And they were running from 5,000 U.S. troops, 3,000 Mexican military types, and innumerable posses They're just 40 people. And I might add as a side remark that with all of those people chasing him, Geronimo never lost a man to capture or being shot. So they were the sole remaining wild, what we would call wild Apaches. The locals called them Bronco Apaches. And they were going on raids, and they came across the border. They went to a little town just north of Nogales called Calabasas, walked down the middle of the street and stole the horses that were tied at the hitching rails, and then went down a canyon where Trinidad's aunt and the man she married, a man named Artisan Peck, lived. And they raided the place. They wound up killing her aunt and her two-year-old cousin. And her aunt had told her to hide before she was killed. And the Apaches came riding up, went in the house, tearing it apart, looking for anything they thought they could use. She was hiding under the bed, and they discovered her there, and they pulled her out and realized that she was just a child, but not a woman yet. And one of them drew his knife to kill her. And about that time, Geronimo walked in and told him to wait. And he wanted to keep her alive. And I suspect, although the history books don't say it, but the Mexican military had captured one of his wives, the one that he probably had the most affection for, a woman named Chihashkish. And he probably wanted to keep Trinidad as a possible swap hostage. But she might also have been just a slave. I don't think he really knew, except that he hated to see someone that young killed. Although it really, in other instances, didn't bother him that would happen. But nobody really knows why he saved her, but he did.
Mm-hmm. There's some really interesting, again, because we get to see things through her eyes. There are things that I didn't know much about the Apache, really. So to me, it was very eye-opening. Mm-hmm. One of the things that she shares is about they're in the mountains. These are this band of Native Americans totally understand that landscape. And where we think of other groups as being more on the plains or the prairies, they really understood this landscape. And they're going through canyons and they're going up into mountains and down and around. And you give us, thank you so much for giving the reader some wonderful tools that really help us, including that map. You give a great map. And then I think you number it kind of by... I know the camera is not going to really pick it up really well, but you give us this great map. And one of the things that we learned is so much of the activity was actually south of the border.
Yeah, that's right. It was. That's where they were hiding. The army had such a large number of soldiers, and they were patrolling the border from roughly Nogales all the way into New Mexico to about Palomas. And it was like a soldier every half mile or so, or troops that had definite routes that they rode. And so the Apaches, the Geronimo Apaches, pretty much stayed out of their line of sight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is kind of amazing, though. You got 5,000 American troops, you know, 25% of the entire United States Army out there after Geronimo and his band of 40. You know, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. You know, he's only got 17 other warriors with him. Those were the men that actually did the fighting. And when you look down the list, and the Army made a complete list of everyone that they captured, when you look down the list, at least three or four of those were basically boys who were old enough to shoot a rifle, and so they got counted. But it's really remarkable. And you know, 5,000 U.S. troops, that's not 5,000 men in the field, because that counts the people that provide the logistics and pack supplies and flash mirrors between mountains and that kind of thing. But still, it was a very large number.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we learned through her eyes again is that their life on the run, but they're packing and unpacking. Women are, she learns, of course, all of the chores that women participate in. What are some of those major things that the women are responsible for, Michael?
Well, when they're on the run like that, the first thing that a man's wife will want to do is try to have him a hot meal when he comes back. Then there's the shelter. The Apaches lived in something called wickiups, which was basically a set of saplings that were stuck in a circle and folded together, and they could cover it with everything from straw to canvas. And in the particular story here, a lot of that cover was canvas, but they didn't bother to do that. You know, if they're going to stop for the night, they're just going to eat. But the women had to know how to live off the land, when they had time, they dug the mezcal hearts, the things that grow the big yucca stalks, for example, and dug pits where they could bake a bunch of that. And they say that it was really, after it was cooked, it was really soft and mushy. And they would pack it up so that it was in little cake-like pieces, and they dried them out, and they could carry that with them and steam them so that they came back to be pretty good. They say that those things taste a lot like molasses. I don't know if you've ever eaten any molasses, but that's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like from everything that Trini's describing, you know, that they really – they ate pretty well, and occasionally there was venison or there was beef or something else that could be added. And but she I think as she realizes this is not the life for me, and I do want to escape. But one of the things is that all there is? You know how we all ask this in our own lives, is that all there is? And she's talking about, here we are, you know, we're packing, we're running, we're unpacking. We take a day or two. We, you know, we breathe. We, and there's joy. There's laughter. There's a wonderful camaraderie among everyone. But then suddenly, okay, you know, he's our leader, and he's got this. He knows we need to, you know, we need to go. And she kind of knows that's not really the life, even if she were to continue there for years before she could escape. She just really doesn't see that this is not the life for me, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although, you know, she She got to be pretty good friends with the young boy who taught her how to use a sling and mm-hmm. Was helping her with the language. And I could just imagine that between that boy and Geronimo's wife, Zaye, that she probably picked up quite a bit. And it's a very tonal, complicated language to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew how to live off the land, and that was in large part because the women really knew how to use desert plants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had a very organized, as you pointed out very, very well, they had a very organized structure. The women had a program, and they knew what they were going to do. The teenagers were practically adults in the assignments they were given. And the young kids, you know, they necessarily helped out. They helped out, but they necessarily didn't get involved, of course, in the fighting or anything like that. But they also didn't seem to cause any problems. They were,
yeah.
I didn't see where discipline was a problem here.
They weren't typical teenagers.
Well, they were for Apaches.
For Apaches. Well, and they had great endurance. There's, you know, she's realizing as much as she's trying to cut, you know, stay on top of everything she's learning, that she's just not built like those her age that are, talk about that, the endurance that they have is amazing.
Yeah, it's you know, from the time that they're off of their cradle boards, they are taught to be physically active. And when they get 4 or 5 years old, they're running virtually every day. Geronimo is well known for training young boys, and he would do things like in the wintertime, he would make them get out and jump in the river when there was ice on it, you know, and they would flop around and then come out and get warm by the fire and then do it again. Or they had to learn to run long distances. And the way that you do that is you have to learn to breathe through your nose. And the way the Apaches made them do that was to take a big swallow of water, run several miles, come back, and spit it out.
Oh,
if they didn't spit it out, then they had to run a lot more miles.
Oh my goodness.
How interesting.
That, yeah, all of that was fascinating. Speaking about water, they really knew, again, they knew this landscape, and they crisscross it throughout the story. That's why that map was so helpful. But they find water in lots of places. In fact, places I wouldn't have necessarily thought of, like water tanks. You know,
no.
Very, very resourceful. And they also often will go back into an area and dig up things that they had deposited there.
Yeah, they were really extraordinarily thoughtful about that. And I guess that comes from literally decades and perhaps several hundred years of learning to preserve their food, put it in a place that we'd call a cache, basically a little cave with something sealed it up that nobody would know where it was. But they did that with food. That's how they kept their food in the summertime to use in the wintertime, the time that they called ghost phase. And they also cached ammunition for their rifles all over the place. And it was really quite extraordinary. There are stories, for example, of women who were taken as slaves, taken to Mexico City, and got away and went like 1,200 miles north to get to their people there in New Mexico and Arizona. And they did that with a little difficulty, except there's a story of the women of a group of women that did that, and they got as far as Deming, New Mexico. They were literally in rags. They didn't want to go back to their people like that. And they found a cave where Victorio had stored a bunch of women's clothes, and they fixed themselves up and went on down the road.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, we talk about food a minute. Coffee?
Yeah.
Coffee seemed to be pretty popular. It was kind of a surprise to me that coffee. They were all drinking coffee.
Well, that's because, you know, the government pushed them on reservations. They got along very well with the Americans for a good while until they started trying to keep them from going into Mexico. But the Americans gave them as part of their ration allotment coffee. And they really developed a good taste for it, and they often served it. And they weren't too happy when they ran out of it.
Understandable.
It didn't sound like it from what we read. Yeah.
I think, did you want to ask about cougar?
Mountain lion? Well, it's kind of interesting. I think you said earlier that they didn't fish much, and they weren't.
They
didn't have much to do with snakes. But it appeared that when it comes to a mountain lion, that was a different story.
Well, it's meat.
Yeah, right. Now, but it was kind of interesting. The one comment made from Geronimo's wife was, "You got to make sure it's well done."
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I've never tried it, so I couldn't say one way or another.
We couldn't.
Well, I haven't either. I'm not anxious to.
we see Geronimo really through Trini's eyes, and they do have a very special relationship. He really does kind of take her under his wing. And I wondered if you just take a moment, and because you write him. I mean, it's through her eyes, but you're revealing him to her as a writer. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that you have tremendous respect for him, mm-hmm. because he's written. We see all sides of him, but there's a lot that we see that is the leader, and he's who everyone's looking up to and such. And I wondered if you might just take a moment and talk about Geronimo.
Sure. He was really an extraordinary individual. He's been called a chief, when in fact he was never a chief. He was what the Apaches called a Dayen, which we would say was a medicine man or a shaman. And he had extraordinary, what we would call supernatural power. And a lot of Apaches were scared to death of him because he had that power. He could stand when they were being chased, hold his arms straight out and turn in a circle. And when his palms started getting warm, that was the direction that the enemy was coming from. There is a recorded instance, there are Apaches who voluntarily told this tale, and more than one saw it, where they were out in the eastern part of Chihuahua looking for people they could kidnap as hostages to trade back for their people that were in slavery. And they were eating one night, and he started to cut a piece of meat, and he just kind of froze and got the 10,000-mile stare and said something like, "Brothers, the blue coats are in our camp. What will we do?" Well, they were 120 miles from their camp, and it was a fact that General Crook had gotten into Mexico, gotten up in the mountains, and found their camp, and had basically taken over. So, you know, he had this power. And when I write it in the book, I use a capital P to show that it's supernatural power. Mm-hmm. He was complex in that he was really a paranoid. The only time that he was the only time he was actually captured was by a trick from an agent named John Klum that was a young man at San Carlos, and Klum captured him, put him in the San Carlos guardhouse, and he stayed there for about 3 months, expecting any moment for the sheriff to show up and take him to be hung. Well, Geronimo prayed and prayed to the Apache god Usun. And as it turned out, Klum resigned and just left. And the new agent didn't see any reason to keep Geronimo in the guardhouse, so he let him out. But the fact that he was in that dark, nasty place for so long, it made him very paranoid, and probably a good reason. So that he always used that as an excuse for leaving the reservation if he thought somebody was about to put him in the guardhouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's John Klum of Tombstone fame, right?
That's right.
Yeah, the same John Klum. Yeah, he pops up here and there.
Yeah, he does.
Were there any things as you did the research, and then of course you're writing the dialogue? That's why it's historical fiction, because your characters are engaging in dialogue and such. Did Trini ever say, no, Michael, I would never say that. I want to say this, you know, did your characters go along with you, or did they surprise you?
Well, characters always surprise you. You know, you sit down and you're writing away, and suddenly the character does something and you're sitting there staring at your words saying, where did that come from? So my biggest problem with Trini was that I didn't want to make her too smart, you know. And I caught myself several times having her think about things and do things that probably only a grown woman would want to do. And so I had to peel that back some.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I understand.
Do you have a process question you'd like to ask? We're kind of moving a little bit into process, Michael. Normally we would take another ad spot, but we don't want to take any time away from talking to you. So we're watching the clock and we know time is ticking. Do you want to talk?
Well, I had a couple. One is, did you ever have writer's block?
No, I don't. The kind of thing that you're talking about is when I run into what I call plot knots.
Plot knots. That's good.
Yeah, I have a very clear idea about what the plot in the story is, but when I get to some points in it, there's a question about how things. excuse me, how things actually work, and why would one person be there and not another? You know, those usual kinds of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tips?
Might
you have a tip for a future writer, up and coming writer, or even a current writer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're writing westerns, you've always got one given character, and that is the land. And I wish I had a nickel for every hour that I have spent studying the lay of the land in Google Earth, which gives you a nice 3D perspective about the way things are. So know the country that you're going to write about, and keep your chapters short. People will actually read more if the chapters are short.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah.
I learned that the hard way, by the way.
You belong to a lot of writers groups and writing associations. What have you found to be benefits of belonging to a writers group?
Well, for me, it's primarily getting to know the other writers and swapping information back and forth. I wrote a book that got reviewed. It was like the second or third book that I had written, and I had a friend that was an artist who did sketches that I put in the book, and I talked to one of the folks that reviewed it, and he said, "Please take those sketches out of there." Because you know, they were good amateur sketches, mm-hmm. but they weren't really professional. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't do it because I had told my friend I was going to put the pictures in there, but I decided I didn't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, having good feedback, not and feedback from family members is not always the best feedback.
No, so, the best.
That would be true.
I after I had done my second novel, I wound up with a very good editor who was not afraid to tell me, you know, this won't work, or the way you've written this really stinks, you know, and. That's the kind of thing that if you want to be a reasonably good writer, and I'm not claiming to be, but that's the kind of advice that you need to have, not somebody that says, "You're the greatest thing since sliced bread."
Yeah, yeah. So, Michael, where can people find you and learn more about you, where you're going to be, other podcast links, things like that? Where do they go?
If they go to wmichaelfarmer.com, that's my website. They'll find all the podcast links that I've been on, and if they want to converse with me via email, it's westernfiction@aol.com.
Jim has a couple of quotes. I know that time is really quickly. I can't believe how fast this is going, but Jim has a couple quotes. Here you go, Jim. You're on.
We like to do a couple of quotes, you know, and we try to bring them from the book, and sometimes we bring them elsewhere. I got one from Trini, and I thought this was kind of good. "The moon was full and bright and riding easy, except in occasional shadows. Blacker than the devil's heart."
She's so descriptive. She's so descriptive.
That's Larry Rapp. And Geronimo, I got a couple from Geronimo. "I was born on the prairies where the wind blew free and there was nothing to break the light of the sun. I was born where there were no enclosures." Mm-hmm. "And wisdom and peace come when you start living the life the Creator intended for you."
Yeah. All found in the book we've been talking about, Trini Come, by our special guest tonight, W. Mike. Next week, our guests, and you know them, are Denise McAllister and Natalie Bright. We met at the Western Writers of America Conference, where we met you as well. And they will be with us next week. We'll be talking about Maverick Heart. And this, we've already started this, and another great read. We want to thank everybody for being with us tonight. Thank you, Michael, so much for your time.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you to Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio and the Hot Texas Swing Band. And on behalf of
Out West, Rendezvous with a Writer, it's always a great day out West.
Keep reading. Keep writing. We'll see you next week.
So long.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.